Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to discuss something that's very, very important because we're in the midst of an epidemic. It's an epidemic of neurodevelopmental problems in our children. As never before, we're encountering kids who have challenges, challenges that in previous times perhaps we're less well recognized, but clearly something is going on because the statistics are just through the roof. We're seeing a very high incidence of kids being medicated in our schools. We're seeing a very high incidence of autism spectrum disorder. And today we're going to talk to one of the most prominent figures in the autism movement. And it is indeed a movement because we're looking for solutions, practical solutions that we can implement in the here and now, and not just very, very advanced research projects that may yield dividends for us in a decade or two. We're going to talk to Dr. Martha Herbert. She is a pediatric neurologist. Now, these days, pediatric neurologists are mostly the people that you go to ask for a prescription for Ritalin or Adderall or something for your kid to straighten him or her out so they do better in school. She, however, has taken a different path towards looking at natural and biomedical solutions, looking to issues related to the environment and nutrition and so on as being very, very central to our understanding of these disorders. She's assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, and she is a neuroscientist at the Mass General Hospital and director of something called the Transcend Research Program. We're going to talk a little bit about that later on. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. Martha Herbert. Dr. Herbert, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So tell us a little bit about how you evolved from, you know, clearly you had classical training. You're a pediatric neurologist. Pediatric neurologists these days, you know, as I mentioned, mostly they deal with problem kids with a prescription pad. You, however, have taken a very, very different approach. How did that come about?
So I didn't. I mean, I have the classical training. I have a medical degree from Columbia, and I did my neurology at Mass General. But you have to understand that I didn't go to medical school until my 30s, and I got a doctorate before that, and I spent a lot of time doing systems biology, systems science, complex systems, history and philosophy of science. So when I started practicing medicine after my residency, it was 1996, and, you know, we didn't call it an epidemic then, but it was starting to be an epidemic. And when I went to see my patients and I did all the workups for the rare metabolic and genetic disorders, people didn't really have them. Every now and then somebody did. But they had common everyday things like diarrhea and they couldn't sleep and skin problems and and what was really interesting to me was that this kind of cluster of everyday problems didn't respect the diagnostic categories. It was across all of the kind of neurological, neuropsychiatric patients that were coming to my clinic, children and adults, but particularly the children. So I had to think about, what is this about?
So you took a more thoughtful approach to this because your initiation was as a scientist, and you said, well, you know, I'm presented with this problem here, and rather than follow, you know, specific algorithms or protocols, if this, then that, prescribe this, or use the prescription pad, you wanted to sort of think out of the box about how these kids might have gone awry.
Well, I was trained in critical thinking. I remember in third year medical school, and I realized, I mean, I have a PhD in, you know, I spent a lot of time with scientists, but it's actually more in the history and philosophy of science and culture area. So I was always taught to analyze how things are working and not to recite what's in the textbook. Over the period of about 8 years, I came up with a formulation that I published in 2005, which was a paper called Autism, a Brain Disorder or a Disorder that Affects the Brain. And in that, I systematized from a systems point of view what it is that holds things. You know, I had this long chart comparing the genetic reductionist model, where you have a gene affecting a specific brain region causing a behavior, to an overall systems disturbance model.
Right.
I should really publish
actually,
that again, because the editor promised that it was going to be indexed, and it's not. So it's on my personal website, marthaherbert.org, this paper.
So what you're saying is, I mean, these days, a lot of autism research is looking towards, let's discover the gene that makes these kids the way they are, that there's some sort of mutation or maybe a recessive gene, or, you know, that something that we'll discover, you know, as if it were something like sickle cell anemia, that we're actually going to discover a flaw in the genetic code that turns kids into autistic children and adults. But what you're saying is that, yeah, maybe the genes are involved, but there's a whole lot more. And that actually gives us the hope that there may be some things that we can do in the here and now to alter the developmental course of these kids.
Totally. You know, actually, I just want to say before I talk on that constructive note, that people need to understand that the idea that this is a genetic disorder is not proved. There are genetic associations, but that doesn't prove that the majority or even the vast majority of people have their autism from a gene. It's also not proved that genes map directly onto behaviors, and it's also not proved that autism has to start prenatally. So people are walking around making interpretations that actually go beyond the evidence. And meanwhile, thousands of kids are getting a lot better, and quite a good number are losing their diagnoses, but they're not mostly doing it just by taking pharmaceuticals or doing behavior therapy. Some people claim that behavior therapy does that, but what I observe is that it's usually a complex, dynamic strategy that targets a lot of different physiological things and tries to upgrade the integrity of the physiology that has been degraded. And why is it degraded? I think critically, the poor food quality combined with excessive noxious exposures that increase nutritional demand. And that's a really bad combination, but it's a combination we can do a lot about.
So to paraphrase what you're saying that kids may be rendered vulnerable perhaps by certain genetic susceptibilities, but there's no inevitability of that, that they're rendered more susceptible to brain problems by bad influences, harmful environmental influences, perhaps chemicals, perhaps even vaccines, you know, all manner of insults that are present in the modern world. And what further complicates it is that with inadequate nutrition, which is, of course, rife in the American culture, that they are less well defended against these insults.
Exactly. And this has the part where I come in more detail than most other people is in thinking, okay, specifically, what is that doing to the brain? So we know from a more and more papers that there's inflammation in the brain in autism. You can see it now on even on PET scans in living individuals, not just in postmortem tissue samples. But then the question is, why does inflammation produce behaviors and cognitive changes like you see in autism? And most people don't ask that question. But I think that what it is there's so many excitatory chemicals and immune factors that the brain is in a state of buzz and confusion from all the internally generated noise, and it isn't really able to attend to the world very well because it's distracted by chemical influences that the brain can't tell the difference between an excitotoxic influence on a synapse and a cell that's synapsing because it just heard a butterfly, heard a bird. You know, it can't tell. So the learning process is altered. And on top of that, the brain is so irritable and excited that stimuli are much more annoying. Sleep is disrupted, and many people with autism even have seizures. So I think, you know, you take the biomedical understanding and then take it upstairs in the brain and really think about how it changes how our brains work. And what you come up with is a model of autism that is not a hardwired map that you're stuck with your whole life, but it's simply a way that the brain acts when its cells are really, really strained and drained and depleted, and they aren't really able to organize information very well, and they're hyper-stimulated but not in an organized way. And that's something that you can do a lot about by helping the brain to heal from that kind of irritation. And the only way you can do that is to help the whole body heal from that kind of irritation.
Now, in your writings, you often use the term allostatic load, or, you know, another way to express it more simply is toxic burden. So where does that come in to this picture? What are some of the insults that can cause the brain to be inflamed or mess up the signaling system in the brain?
Yeah, well, there's one more term which I like, which is cumulative impact, which is that you start getting exposed to things. A body burden can build up in your cells and tissues and fluids and bones and lipids and so forth. And to the extent that you don't keep up with it in terms of flushing it out, which you're not going to keep up with it if your diet is poor because you won't be supplying the cells with what they need to keep up with it. And anyhow, it's hard to keep up with this much toxicity. It's like putting molasses or sand in a gearbox. I mean, it just makes everything inefficient. Maybe some things more than others. But it's the inefficiency and the kind of too much noise, not enough signal problem. I think that that's what's driving the behaviors. And you can hunt all you want for some specific gene or some specific brain region or some specific target for pharmaceutical. But it's a whole system that is being degraded. And you really have to deal with that whole system. Otherwise, you're only going to get limited results,
so,
if anything.
So what are some of the things that conspire to disrupt the brain? You know, we're talking environmental chemicals.
Sure.
We're talking heavy metals. We're talking, you know, a lot of different theories have arisen.
Yeah.
Do you think they all may play a role? You even have actually done some work on electromagnetic fields.
Yeah, and I just sat on a PhD dissertation of a public health student talking about autism and Tylenol, acetaminophen.
Uh-huh.
And there's quite striking findings accumulating in the literature. It's really damning about asthma. So,
the OBGYN's favorite medication for
Tylenol.
Pregnant women. They say, well, you know, if you don't take maybe they say don't take Advil, but you take as much Tylenol as you need because that's pretty benign.
And it's interesting data that after 1996, when more places started medicating newborn boys getting circumcised, Tylenol, every 4 hours for a day for their pain because they were more concerned about pain management. Mm. There's epidemiological data showing that in the areas that were doing that, but not in the areas that were not, there's a statistically significant increase in boys with autism. So, you know, it's a very that Tylenol thing is going to get hit the big time one of these days, hopefully in the not too distant future, because there's more and more people on it. But the point, I wrote a paper in 2010, which had a concept that I think is really important, which is environmentally vulnerable physiology. So think about the mitochondria. They can be poisoned or interfered with by tens of thousands of things, by drugs, by toxins. They can be injured by electromagnetic fields, by nutritional deficiencies, plus all sorts of mutations that they don't repair very well that they can acquire during the lifetime. You don't have to be born with problems like that. So what you have is many, many different agents. You may get hit with a large dose of one of them, but honestly, if you get hit with small doses of lots of things that target a much smaller number of our defense mechanisms, you don't even need to have a big exposure. It's the cumulative impact of all of these things wearing down our fundamental environmental protection apparatus in our body. And right, at some point, you cross a tipping point.
And you know, I guess the analogy that's often used is my cup runneth over. You know, you have a certain capacity to absorb some of these environmental toxins. I mean, in nature, we do get exposed to, quote, natural poisons. But the body exhibits something called resilience until such point as they overaccumulate. And then, you know, literally your cup runneth over and into symptoms and systemic problems. So resilience is a term that you actually incorporate in something you have dubbed the Transcend program. That's a program for parents of kids with developmental disorders. And it's an acronym, which includes the word resilience.
Yeah, actually, the acronym in treatment research and neuroscience evaluation of neurodevelopmental disorders, but I also now have a private practice in the community in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Body Brain Resilience Center. And I think resilience is absolutely critical. It's the opposite of fragility. Fragility is what happens to us. The less good supports we have, particularly food and, you know, of course, clean water and clean air and love and community, and more things that wear us down that interfere with our biology. So resilience is something that everyone can aim for, no matter what their present state. People of any type of health status, age, or whatever can all aim to make choices that increase their resilience rather than drive it down. And for people who already have obvious challenges, it's every choice is – you should make every choice a healthy choice. But honestly, with the world the way it is, pretty much everybody should do that. I mean, I've been on an internet discussion about this paper. It came out a few years ago, but for some reason it popped up again about how there won't be any more saltwater fish in the ocean by 2048. So we had a big discussion about that, and is it real science? And it was in Science magazine. So, you know, if that's the level of destruction that we're dealing with, we really don't have time to play around with unhealthy choices.
Well, it's been said that if you understand autism, or, you know, clearly we don't completely understand it, but if you have a beginning of understanding all the complex systems involved in that end result, you really have unraveled the secret to many disorders, many adult disorders. And certainly we see a lot of adult neurological disorders. We have this terrible epidemic of cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis. you know, perhaps these are all related, and the autistic kids are sort of the canaries in the coal mine of a devastating ecological disaster that's afflicting mankind.
Like, I think about autism as what happens to the brain in development from the same factors that are driving, you know, climate change and the disruption of the oceans and the loss of biodiversity. I mean, we're dealing with it in many different facets. When you look at the genetics and underlying biology of neurodegenerative diseases, chronic diseases, and autism, there's actually a lot of overlap. I have a postdoc. I've been looking at this, hope to publish it soon. It's quite striking how not unique each of these diseases is. I mean, it's like the underlying parts are so similar, it's interesting that they sort of fractionate out with different symptom patterns. But that's just where the fault lines are. The stressors on the fault line are not that different from one of these conditions to another. It's just that different people have different weak points. So the way the genetics would contribute is not by causing the disease, but just where it's going to break down first.
You know, I interviewed you before for a short video cast for my professional organization, ACAM, where you spoke recently. And, you know, after speaking to you for a few minutes, I came to the realization, I shared it with you, that although you're a neuroscientist and a board-certified pediatric neurologist, you actually, with all that classical training, you actually have the outlook of a naturopathic physician who, you know, basically schooled in principles of natural healing rather than, you know, laser-like focus on you know, the magic bullet type drug that's going to, you know, cure a disease.
Look, I studied with Gregory Bateson. I studied with Ivan Illich.
The anthropologist,
Herbert Marcuse. I studied with these remarkable people. There's no way I could be laser-like and targeted like that. I studied, you know, I've been around some of the best systems thinkers in the world for the last number of decades. So I have a lineage. I studied with Richard Levins. I studied with a lot of fascinating people who taught me how to think. So, I think that the naturopaths and also the osteopaths have so much that they've known, and that if you look at the science now, there's so much more coming up that supports the principles of what people have been saying in those professions for a long time. And they're not, you know, not just professions, but I've been really interested in the extracellular matrix and the extracellular fluids. There's an enormous amount of literature in neuroscience about the extracellular matrix that literature was hardly there 10 years ago. And we're finding that these fluids that bathe the synapses and bathe everything have a lot to do with how the neurons function. We already been talking about glial cells for a while, but now it's turning out that these fluids and connective tissues that the naturopaths and osteopaths have been talking about for years may well be a very important part of the target of nutritional and biomedical interventions, as well as many of the cleansing regimens that the naturopaths have been talking about for so long, and so have many traditional cultures. So, you know, in a way, the narrow targeted approach is incredibly outdated in a world of systems biology. It's just that there isn't as much of a business model for this systemic approach.
Exactly. It seems that, you know, when we approach diseases, we're basically looking for laser-like focus of patentable drugs. And you look at drug prices these days, some of the drugs that are used, you know, these monoclonal antibodies that target very specifically one link in the chain of biochemical reactions and either block it or augment it, these drugs cost upwards of $100,000 a year per patient and offer, you know, sometimes limited benefits with a lot of side effects. Do you think that ultimately these types of medications will be foisted on autistic children in the future? Is this the future of autism treatment?
I think it's not the future of successful autism treatment, but I think it's the future of the way funding is going to be given to treatment research because of the political pressures coming from the industry. You know, I'm working on a movie called Documenting Hope, and we're setting up the infrastructure to systematically track the recovery processes of 14 children with 7 diagnoses: autism, allergies, asthma, diabetes, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, obesity. And our premise is that we can get these kids better by natural methods, and that we're going to measure it scientifically to show the systems biology of the recovery process. And, you know, the thing is, as long as we hang on to that targeted approach, people are not going to really get that much better. The only way you're going to get really better is what Dale Bredesen talked about in his wonderful paper on reversal of mild cognitive impairment. In 10 out of 11 yeah. people, there are 36 holes in the roof. It's not going to stop leaking until you patch all 36 holes. That's his metaphor.
Yeah, for those not familiar with it, it's a comprehensive protocol involving diet, exercise, and certain key supplements, and possibly also some element of stress reduction, which dramatically reversed cognitive decline in a small series, admittedly a small series of patients, but really kind of is a roadmap for how we can deal with the problem of Alzheimer's and cognitive decline naturally using simple, low-tech, inexpensive interventions.
It isn't that different from what many of us are doing in autism. You know, it's amazing how much a really cleaned up, natural, non-processed, organic, you know, or better diet. That's foundational. Whatever else you may add in terms of supplements or whatever, repurposed drugs are not my favorite way to approach this, I have to say. But you have to get, because there are things about food that you can't really put into a product in any comprehensive way past a certain very, very limited point. So it's almost like we have to fight for our food right now. It's almost like in some aspects, good food becomes a little bit like contraband that you have to go out and score because
right.
you can't even buy it in the store. It's a really backward situation. But I think that more and more people are connecting the dots and putting it together with their own health and the health of the planet and the economic system that is not on our side in terms of the bottom 90 or 99%. You know, so it becomes more palpable when either a person gets sick themselves or their kid or someone they love gets sick. That's the turning point for many people. Up until then, people have an easy time just believing that everything is sort of fine and we really don't have to think about this silly diet and these people with parents with children with autism should stop being so difficult and on and on. And then you get hit with it and you realize very fundamentally, personally, what the problem is and that it's transformative. And so one of the reasons that these movements of people with chronic illness can be so strong and intense is that people have a direct understanding of the process of getting sick and the process of seeing improvement that makes them change their worldview and change what's important to them. And I'm hoping, you know, there was a paper some years ago that Michael Lerner wrote. He's the head of Commonweal Institute, about the age of extinctions in the emerging environmental movement. You know, we are all suffering from the same degradation of the planet, the degradation of the coral reefs. The coral reefs are like an intestine turned inside out. They're dying. They're dying in a time frame of decades. This is not unrelated to the terrible state of the microbiome in so many millions or even billions of people on the planet right now. We've been so happy by killing all this stuff with antibiotics. I mean, I think it's stunning that antibiotics were invented 80, 90 years ago and we're already destroying their effectiveness.
Absolutely.
This pinnacle of modern medicine is already becoming, there's hardly any broad-spectrum antibiotics that really work. There's so many antibiotic-resistant organisms. What were we thinking? What were we thinking or not thinking? It's really amazing. So, well, you know, and even in the United States, they're finally going to start doing something about antibiotics.
Curbing the use of antibiotics.
Curbing in the agriculture. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, this serves as a great introduction to the subject of natural treatment of developmental disorders for kids. As our listeners know, we divide these podcasts into two parts. So what we're going to do is we're going to continue with our discussion with Dr. Martha Herbert. And we're going to discuss some of the practical implications of her research in terms of things that parents can do to prevent neurodevelopmental problems from arising in the first place, or to dial back some of the changes that affect kids to such an alarming extent these days. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, our guest Dr. Martha Herbert, and we'll give you some information on how to contact her, should you be interested in learning more, in part two of today's podcast. This is Intelligent Medicine.